Today's episode of What's the Big Idea is brought to you by routine. There's a certain comfort in our day-to-day routine, especially if you're still teaching and interacting with students. With so much unknown about how this crisis will be resolved and when, we can take comfort in daily routines with family and work to help us get through. I hope all of you are well and healthy. Now on to the show. Welcome to What's the Big Idea? I'm your host, Dan Carney. On April 28th, Governor Gavin Newsom of California announced a four-stage plan for reopening the state. Interestingly, the plan is based on benchmarks, not dates, and those benchmarks center largely around the availability of testing and contact tracing. In this, Newsom is not alone. 49 other governors are wrestling with questions of when and how to reopen and how to balance public safety with the economic sacrifice. In stage two of Newsom's plan are schools. Schools can reopen, in some fashion, in some form, when California reaches the next stage. Newsom even said that school could start up again in July or August, essentially extending the next school year, likely in hopes of recouping lost time. But what will school look like? Without a COVID-19 vaccine, schools can't simply throw open their doors and get back to learning as usual. Life in the age of coronavirus, social distancing, masks, gloves, watching out for the most vulnerable, will certainly find its way into short and medium-term school life. To get some perspective on this question, I called Chris Chang. Chris is a 7th grade history teacher in the Bay Area of California, and he's also a former school board member. He's also someone who's done a lot of thinking about this topic, and he's closely examined what schools in Asia and Europe are doing. This conversation gave me a lot to think about, and if you're mulling this question over, as a teacher, administrator, parent, I think you'll find his insights to be very helpful.
Hi, so I'm Chris Chain. This is my 16th year teaching, and I currently teach middle school in Los Gatos in Northern California. But my career, I've taught every grade from kindergarten, in the 16 years, kindergarten to 12th grade. And most of it in high school, and recently in middle.
And what's the last month been like for you and your students?
So we sheltered pretty early on. So we've been doing this since March 14th. So the last month and a half, we were speaking a little earlier before the recording about my school setup is in a one-on-one device setting. So a lot of the learning platforms, the means to deliver content, the means to deliver feedback, were practices that students were already accustomed to and the teachers already knew how to do. So we were lucky in that case. There are a lot of schools that where a lot of my colleagues in other schools didn't have that in place. So for us, the one learning curve was just the remote learning, the virtual conferencing tool. We use Google Meets or Google Apps school. So that was really the one tool that we had to learn. Everything else was already in place. So that made that a lot smoother than I think than what's typical.
What surprised you, maybe not just at your own school, but just kind of watching the national landscape or the statewide landscape here in California, what surprised you the most about just what's gone on since education has moved online?
Well, for our profession of teaching, I think it's been very interesting to see, and also just inspiring to see how quickly professional development in a very organic kind of DIY way of it, this has been, how quickly practices have been developed. You know, like teaching, we often see things as moving very glacially and slow. And I think that, and also I think a lot of schools often overanalyze how much like top-down support is needed, and like there's a lot of planning and kind of like, you know, like it's D-Day operations to usually roll out new practices and new tools. And yet, I mean, the urgency and necessity of things have been that like it's teachers are learning to teach in whole new ways and hours what schools had traditionally thought would take months I mean, it usually takes a year to roll out a learning platform. And yet here we are, we have colleagues who are launching a LMS, a learning platform, in a matter of overnight.
Yeah, that's definitely been my experience with teachers who just have taken these giant leaps in their understanding because they had to. Yeah. And now they're better teachers for it, I think.
So, yes, I think that when we eventually return to our traditional settings, the tools that teachers have and the kind of processes that kids are familiar with, I think that's going to be a pretty transformative outcome of it.
Yeah. So you just mentioned traditional settings. For obvious reasons, you know, people are pretty eager to get out of this social distancing environment that we're in. And there's been a lot of talk online, teachers saying, I can't wait to get back to see kids in the fall. I can't wait to start, you know, doing this in the fall. Mm-hmm. But are we being unrealistic to start thinking in those terms?
I mean, I think every week schools are waiting on what the governor and the state says. And in many ways, I think behind the scenes, the state and the governor are listening to what schools are trying to say. So I think that this is a really quickly evolving landscape, but I think it's safe to assume that too many families depend on schools to not have schools open in some way, right? So people can't work if they are home watching their children. That said, you know, there are these social distancing and building capacities. I mean, schools are by definition dense places. So I think it's interesting. You know, it's interesting to see what other countries are doing. You know, I've been paying a lot of attention to noticing the similarities and differences between what's going on in Europe and East Asia. And I think a lot of that's going to play out when we in California since we get to benefit from seeing what the Europeans and what they're doing in Asia as well.
Do you actually want to talk a bit about that? I know you've been tweeting a bit about Denmark, Germany, and Taiwan. Do you want to talk a bit about what you've observed and what lessons we could take from those countries?
Well, I mean, so both, you know, so Denmark and Austria, some other countries, Iceland as well, they've either opened up school in some capacity or never closed some grade levels, you know. So in Sweden, you know, it's students under 16 have not ever closed. They've been in class all this time. And in Taiwan, they opened up about maybe 3-4 weeks ago. So the biggest difference between the European and East Asian countries have to do with the logistics of that East Asian schools don't have the luxury of open space. So my family's from Taiwan, and I went to school myself in Taiwan for a while. My school in Taiwan that I attended in middle school had no yard. It was a building, you know. You had floors, and you know, a basketball court was considered a spacious luxury, not open grass fields and things. So when you look at these the models in Denmark and things of these, that if you look at these pictures of these vast open spaces and having class outdoors and having classes where you have, you know, 10 kids, I think that's a very Scandinavian model, but they're also very European. In East Asia, these are urban settings. So the biggest difference in East Asia has been the focus on wearing of personal protection equipment, a mask in the classroom. You see pictures in Denmark of kids without mask. Yet if you look at a picture in Taiwan, everybody's got a mask and it's on all day. And in fact, in Taiwan, for the schools, some schools, you know, if you take off a mask, you have to actually put on a physical barrier of something on your desk, like a test cubicle, so that the minute your mask comes off, a physical barrier has been constructed around you so you can eat at your desk with a little cardboard barrier around you. So I think that's a very Asian approach out of necessity that they are still doing distancing. I know in Taiwan they are kind of restricting class sizes and restricting. I think that's interesting to see which approach California will go, right? Because California, we do have open fields and stuff like that, but we have large class sizes. So it's kind of like we can take a cue from Taiwan. Taiwan, it's like a physical constraint. And actually, Taiwan also has really large class sizes too. So, yeah.
Yeah, because I've seen the pictures from Europe, and obviously it looks great. They're out and outside. They're out together studying, talking, discussion, whatever it is. But the reality is, even here in California, even if we have open spaces, we still need to be in the classroom at some time. So I'm really curious in the Taiwan model, how are they balancing the class sizes? How are they kind of managing the logistics of that? And I guess my bigger question is, do you think that works? I mean, do you think that the kids are going to learn in this environment where they have these sort of COVID-19 cubicles and masks? Do you think that there's still going to be school happening, or is it sort of an approximation of school?
I mean, it depends on what we prioritize. If our priority is to get kids on campus so people can go back to work, then dynamic interaction and instruction may not be as important if it's purely that it's a necessity of childcare in that sense. I mean, and actually in Europe, that's kind of playing out too. Even though they have open space in schools, it's been reported in Denmark that teachers are having to really rely on a lot more of direct instruction because kids aren't allowed to kind of one-on-one interact with small groups. Some schools in Denmark are reporting that like they're really careful about even handing things to each other. So like shared materials, supplies, even turning in assignments, kids are self-correcting papers more in the countries being reported in Europe. We could imagine that, you know, it's like, it's not really about having kids have a dynamic instruction being back at school, but it's largely just they're back at school. Something in California looks like, the Governor Newsom said that it looks like will likely be some part of our experience in the fall are staggered schedules or rotations. And that's something that European countries are doing, like Iceland's doing that as well. Less so in Taiwan. In Taiwan, kind of like everyone's at school. And it looks like that, I'm guessing for us, we will have, whether it be literally full rotations of only a portion of the school on campus any given day, or at the very least, staggered entry levels. Especially if we plan to do any kind of temperature checking or things like that. If a school, entering school becomes like entering an airport, then you definitely have to have staggered schedules.
Absolutely.
If we're checking people's temperatures and stuff.
Yeah, you put something out recently, models to reduce occupancy, and you propose different tracks to sort of accommodate all students and staff. You want to talk about those tracks you proposed?
So I used to be on the school board here. I teach in Los Gatos, but I live in Mount View. And in our city of Mount View, when I was on the school board, Mount View in the Silicon Valley, there's always been a lot of parents who are really hands-on with their kids' education. And we have a kind of a strong homeschooling community that used to be supported by the school district as well through independent study. And so that kind of gave me this perspective that in the fall, we're going to have some kids who families won't want to send back regardless of what we offer. And in the Silicon Valley, that's a little more possible in the sense that there's a high percentage of workers who can telecommute being in the tech sector, not the case in every part of the state. But whether because their parents have vulnerability of people, somebody being sick at home that they don't want their kids to go to school and bring it back, or the child have an impaired immunity or just anxiety or concerns of caution the parents may have, I think it's reasonable to think that there's going to be a track of kids who don't want to be at school. Equally so, there's going to be some of our colleagues in teaching who have impaired immunity, who that very idea of going back to school in any way seems to be a risk to their health. So I think that in addition to rotating kids in and out, there's a good reason to explore having a track that still continues to be remote 100% of the time. And that could literally look like just offering kids what they're offered right now all through fall semester. It could look like what we had in Mountain View before, which was a independent study track, which was basically homeschool support. So, because we have many families who have decided to kind of skip the instruction being offered by the school and kind of homeschool on the fly. That's been happening a lot, and you hear a lot of families kind of just teaching their own kids, whether it be to supplement, I mean, in percentages, whether it be like augmenting what they get from their teachers or skipping totally, ignoring school instructions and doing their own. I think that actually usually in schools find that threatening because it reduces enrollment. But if our goal is to open school for those who need it, and central workers and people who have to be on campus, Yet we want to have fewer kids on campus. It's a situation maybe where we welcome. We welcome. It's like, if there are people who know they don't want to be on campus, let's find out who they are and let's support. Let's actually support how they can be at home so that we have as few people on campus as possible, which also allows the idea that perhaps we offer daycare. So I'm thinking if we have a third of the campus on site at any given time for direct instruction, and then a third of the school site who has opted to be fully be offsite to never come on campus, maybe that could bring another third or so on campus to that's in like in a daycare setting, maybe working with kind of what we usually have with like after school care support. If we are going to do what the governor says and possibly have a rotation, a lot of districts are talking about doing like a cohort A's on campus, cohort B's off. There are some families that will not work. This idea of having a school for them for just 2-3 days a week, they still have to go to work. We have teachers who say, what am I going to do with my child who's in another grade level, who's on a different rotation? So if we encourage some families to be off all the time, it allows us to bring some kids on campus all week. Yet we can't logistically provide those kids instruction all week. So providing daycare for them. So it's like, let's say cohort A, this was their days to actually be at home. And the teachers had planned on giving them lessons to do at home. Yet let's say in that cohort, we have some kids who really need to be on campus. Well, if they were provided daycare, they could do the remote instruction at school in a separate setting, safe for them. So this way, essential workers, nurses, and teachers and things, they can know that their child is on campus, but we didn't have to give them a whole nother track. They're just there doing what they would have done at home.
Yeah. Well, you're describing a very, what sounds like it could be a scheduling nightmare for schools, sort of like a 20 circle Venn diagram that's sort of what the circles are moving. So how about for teachers? I'm trying to think of teachers here who some have adjusted very well to this new remote learning world. Others are maybe struggling a bit. How would teachers, if you're seeing some students sometimes, some students maybe never because they're off campus. I'm just trying to kind of think through the logistics of teaching in that kind of environment where it's more fluid.
But something I think would be logical would be if we had some teachers who signed up to be doing remote teaching all semester. So it was a remote track. So hypothetically, let's say if I knew that I safely could not be on campus, whether because of somebody I live with at home or my own medical conditions, then it'd be nice if there was a way where that teacher could sign on to say, well, they will then volunteer to be doing remote teaching and maybe work with the kids in a remote setting. And then for the teachers who are on campus, what their schedule wouldn't really look that different because it would look like basically a short week, right? To be like the days you're on campus, you're planning for projects for kids to do when they're off campus.
Sure. Yeah.
Twice a week. And it's not too different from teachers who teach on a block schedule, what a rotation would look like. So I think that wouldn't look too different. Logistically about doing daycare, not all school sites do daycare right now, but for schools who have like YMCA or programs on campus, it's not that different to imagine, or schools that have TK or transitional kindergarten on campus. It's like not hard to imagine you partition off half the school that's just being at like school care. So it's not longer at school, but so it's like they're just there to do what they would do at home, but under a supervised setting so their parents can go work. So from a teacher standpoint, if I was teaching on campus, I wouldn't really have to worry about what they're doing at daycare. I just assign them work that they do either at home or on campus on the other side.
Yeah. So our governor, Gavin Newsom, announced just a few days ago a 4-stage plan to reopen California. Interestingly, though, it was based on benchmarks, not time. What is going to be required for school to begin to look normal again? What's going to need to happen for us to really go back to school, quote unquote?
Well, normal means kids be able to shake hands and pass crayons and teachers be able to give hugs. And so that's immunity, right? That's immunity, whether by vaccine or by natural transmission. Mm-hmm. I'm not, as an educator, anticipating regular classroom until the scientists and doctors can provide us immunity. So to me, I'm not even thinking, this just seems like a year-long effort that school's not going to look traditional.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I'm anticipating I'm going to see my kids in the fall, but in a setting, because after all, I mean, kids are being seen in other countries already. So it's not mm-hmm. like that doesn't happen. But in those countries, classrooms don't seem normal either, because kids aren't
right.
be able to touch each other.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm thinking of the schools that are the most sort of experiential, maybe project-based, where the kids are constantly up and moving and interacting, the shock to their systems is going to be probably pretty intense, as you said, maybe more direct instruction so that the students are kind of self-sufficient in their desk.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. It's like, if we see school as a place that's going to be open just so the kids have a place to go, it may in some ways be less interactive than what we do in Zoom or Meet. In Zoom and Meet, we don't have masks on, right? So we can see each other's faces. If a child goes to school and then like everyone they talk to is behind a mask and everyone they talk to is in 6 feet distance, that in some ways may feel as in an awkwardly distant way.
What do you think the long-term effects on education are going to be? You know, I find myself agreeing with you that it's going to be a while, right? But the vaccine or the herd immunity, this is not something that's going to suddenly happen by the fall. Assuming we sort of are in this mixed model or these tracks, as you described, for a year or more, how do you think education might be changed in the long term?
One thing that's it's already happening is educational technology has become no longer like an optional. It's become like EdTech is like the center of how everything gets delivered now. I think that that's going to be long-term now. Those tools and skills won't go away. But I think every month, I hope actually that schools begin to really adopt the different ways of doing projects. And there's a lot of cool things you can do with EdTech, you know, virtual tutors, coding, you know, making films, making podcasts like what this is, you know, these are a lot of fun things kids can do. And the kids have the devices now. You know, it's been for years school districts debating whether to go 101. And literally every school district in the country now has the goal of being 101, is trying to find the resources to get there. That was done in a month. You know, things that took years of abstract debate, we are now as a country all 101. So in that realm, this is so much is about educational technology and independent schools. You know, this would mean like hiring coaches. And I mean, these are like large logistical efforts to do 101 rollouts. We've skipped all that. Every kid has a device now. The sad thing is a lot of this is kind of without training and without standardization. You know, like, and, you know, we have a lot of public schools where kids have Chromebooks, iPads. I mean, they've like basically like, you know, gutted whatever computers they had and just pass them out, you know, in Alaska, they're taking donations and sending them out. So it's very different from a standardized independent school where everybody has the same control device.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I guess one of the long-term effects I was thinking of was just equity in terms of schools that could, as you described, kind of in a lot of ways seamlessly roll into this because students were used to it, but in areas where students maybe don't have reliable internet or maybe just because of their home environment, they just can't get online when they need to. Will this sort of even deepen the divide between those students that can kind of keep on going with their learning and those that maybe can't?
Well, I think that right now the divide is very apparent, but if remote is going to be part of the fall, I think that actually I think legally and ethically, there's not going to be a single school in the country that's going to be able to get away with saying some kids don't have devices. Mm. Like, you could say that right now we're on pass fail for most schools or optional or enrichment. So if somebody writes off the last 2 months of school, which some people consider, you know, time of standardized testing and things, you can't write off a semester. You can't write off a year. So I think a lot of the forward-looking districts are already, you know, calling every family to find out, do they need a laptop? Do they need a Comcast internet voucher or something like that? And those who haven't been doing that, I think will be forced to in the fall because California, I mean, the whole country, it falls under the 14th Amendment. And like, you know, when you look at these court cases about equitable access in schools, I don't think it would pass constitutional muster to go into a full semester, assuming it's part of it's remote, and allow some kids to not have internet or computers.
Wow. So and that would be a massive shift in the way we think about education. If schools are forced to provide that for their students, that would, as you said,
right? I mean, tens of thousands of computers left out every week in a lot of these big school districts.
Sure. How are your own students coping? What have you kind of noticed with your own students in terms of their, not just how they're handling it academically, but just emotionally, socially?
So I teach seventh graders, and so these are tweens. They kind of have some, you know, I would say they're tweens and teenagers are definitely tuned in with what's going on in the world, right? So they're not living in a bubble. So I think luckily a lot of my families aren't facing immediate. I mean, at the independent school, I mean, the economic impact has been different depending on whether you're in public schools or not. I mean, a lot of my colleagues in the public schools, they're experiencing large percentage of their families furloughed or having lost their job. In my school, I would say that while that may not be the immediate impact, the kids are just definitely watching the news and feeling the stress, feeling a sense of overall sadness. And that, I think, the biggest impact I think that has is kind of just on their productivity. You know, kids, I think all of us get often more or less get motivated by seeing other people work or doing group assignments. And we're doing some group assignments virtually, but I think a lot of motivation to like stay productive is really hard for the kids. I
mean, and teachers sometimes.
So you have this idea that you turn on the news, and these kids are old enough to turn on the news, and it's kind of a down, you know, brings them down. That impacts productivity. And then they don't see their peers working on the same work they're working on. Well, that reduces our productivity. And then the teacher's not there to kind of edge them on. So I would say that, you know, kids are working slower. That said, I think kids are still welcoming the comfort of seeing, like when there is virtual classes, kids are very much like, there's something comforting to that, you know? And I, as a teacher, I have, I adjust my workload to kind of not be as, I adjust it based on thinking that kids have to take more time to do things. If I had to ballpark it, I'm doing about a third of the pace I would usually do.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's been certainly one of my big takeaways from this is the need to just slow everything down and be very responsive, even more responsive in the classroom. Yeah. You described earlier that there's a certain DIY feel, to this whole thing. Do you anticipate the state sort of providing some clear guidelines a la Germany, Denmark, or in Taiwan? Or do you think this is going to be kind of a school by school or district by district decision as to what school looks like in the fall?
Governor Newsom has said that he's really wanting to listen to what schools say. But school districts and school boards, they have been saying they kind of on the edge of their seats on every word the governor says. So there is this kind of loop. There has been, it's funny, I had a friend who was an educator who said that as much as everyone's waiting for the governor, some people are getting tired that they're waiting on kind of what seems like an open stream of consciousness coming out of the governor when it comes when the governor, and I mean, a lot of the stuff he says ended up being true, but like when he first said that school will likely not reopen, he said that at a time when most schools were still planning on telling the parents back in 2 weeks.
Yes, so, there were some shockwaves when he said that. Yeah.
Yeah. So speaking off the cuff there for him, I think, so there is kind of this chicken and egg thing of everyone's saying they're waiting for the other person. And I would say that in the end, schools are going to follow what the states and what the public health, as much as everyone's saying they want to know what the schools say, schools are going to follow what the medical professionals say because this is a health issue. So now I don't think health professionals will be telling teachers on exactly, you know, where, what periods it have and when to start school. But they'll set the parameters, right? They'll tell us how many people can be in the building. And then from there, I think we'll see a lot of diversity. I think so once we get the parameters on school can or cannot open, how many kids could be on campus. I think from there, you'll see a lot of variability.
Right. Okay. Well, Chris, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. You got some great insights on the international scene, which I think is going to become very important here very soon as schools start to think about the fall. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks. Be safe, and it was good talking to you.
Thanks to Chris for that conversation. I'll post on Twitter some of his diagrams, which are really helpful in illustrating his thinking about this question of what schools will look like when and how they come back. In the meantime, as Chris noted, this is a very fluid situation. Almost day to day, schools are looking at the governor is looking at schools, and we still have a long way to go until we reach the middle summer months and some hard decisions have to be made. I hope this episode gave you some food for thought as your own school begins to think about next year. Thanks for listening to What's the Big Idea, and check us out next time.
Extraño es cuando te encuentro por segunda vez y no me conformo con mirar tu piel. Mañana te invito a un doble café.